That brute, being brutalized, was not wholly unpleasant, but when Withers hit the deck and disfiguring blows began to fall, I proposed a tactful exit stage left to our borrowed vehicle. We departed via the back and scuttled over the blustery car park as fast as our legs, whose combined age well exceeded 3 centuries, could carry us. I drove north. Where all this will end, I do not know. The end. Very well, dear reader, you deserve an epilogue if you've stayed with me this far. My ghastly ordeal touched down in this spotless Edinburgh rooming house, kept by a discreet widow from the Isle of Man. After the brawl at the Hanged Edward, we 4 blind mice drove to Glasgow, where Ernie knows a bent copper who can take care of the Hotchkiss vehicle. Here our fellowship parted. Ernie, Veronica, and Mr. Meeks waved me off at the station. Ernie promised to take the flak, if the law were ever to catch up, as he's too old to stand trial, which is ruddy civilized of him. He and Veronica were headed to a Hebridean location, where Ernie's handyman preacher cousin does up falling down crofts for Russian mafiosi and German enthusiasts of the Gaelic tongue. I offer my secular prayers for their well-being. Mr. Meeks was to be deposited in a public library with a "Please look after this bear" tag, but I suspect Ernie and Veronica will take him with them. After my arrival at Widow Manx's, I slept under my goose-down quilt as sound as King Arthur on the Blessed Isle. Why didn't I get on the first train south to London, there and then? I'm still not sure. Maybe I recall Denham's remark about life beyond the M25. I shall never know what part he played in my incarceration, but he was right. London darkens the map like England's bowel polyp. There is a whole country up here. I looked up Mrs. Latham's home number at the library. Our telephone reunion was a moving moment. Of course, Mrs. Latham smothered her emotion by lambasting me, before filling me in on my missing weeks. The Hoggins Hydra had ripped the office apart when I failed to show for my 3 o'clock castration, but years of financial brinkmanship had stood my redoubtable pit prop in good stead. She had captured the vandalism on a cunning video camera supplied by her nephew. The Hogginses were thus restrained. "Steer clear of Timothy Cavendish," Mrs. Latham warned, "or this footage will appear on the Internet, and your various probations shall hatch into prison sentences." Thus they were prevailed upon to accept an equitable proposal, cutting them into future royalties. I suspect they had a sneaking admiration for my lady bulldog's cool nerves. The building management used my disappearance and the trashing of my suite as an excuse to turf us out. Even as I write, my former premises are being turned into a hard rock cafe for homesick Americans. Cavendish Publishing is currently run from a house owned by my secretary's eldest nephew, who resides in Tangier. Now for the best news. A Hollywood studio has optioned Knuckles Sandwich the movie for a figure as senselessly big as the number on a barcode. A lot of the money will go to the Hogginses, but for the first time since I was 22, I am flush. Mrs. Latham sorted out my bank cards, etc., and I am designing the future on beer mats, like Churchill and Stalin at Yalta, and I must say the future is not too shabby. I shall find a hungry ghostwriter to turn these notes you've been reading into a film script of my own. Well, sod it all. If Dermot Duster Hoggins can write a bestseller and have a film made, why the ruddy hell not Timothy Lazarus Cavendish? Put Nurse Noakes in the book, the doc, and on the block. The woman was sincere, bigots mostly are, but no less dangerous for that, and she shall be named and shamed. The minor matter of John's Hotchkiss's vehicle loan needs to be handled with delicacy, but fouler fish have been fried. Mrs. Latham got on the email to Hilary V. Hush to express our interest in half-lives, and the postman delivered part 2, not an hour ago. A A photo was enclosed, and it turns out the V is for Vincent. And what a lard bucket! I'm no Chippendale myself, but Hillary has the girth to fill not two but three airline economy seats. I'll find out if Louisa Ray is still alive in a corner of the Whistling Thistle, my de facto office, and erect galleon of a back-alley tavern where Mary, Queen of Scots, summoned the devil to assist her cause. The landlord, whose double measures would be quadruples in management-consulted Londinium, swears he sees her ill-starred Majesty regularly, in vino veritas. That is more or less it. Middle age is flown, but it is attitude, not years, that condemns one to the ranks of the undead, or else proffers salvation. In the domain of the young there dwells many an undead soul. They rush about so. Their inner putrefaction is concealed for a few decades, that is all. Outside, fat snowflakes are falling on slate roofs and granite walls. Like Solzhenitsyn laboring in Vermont, I shall beaver away in exile, far from the city that knitted my bones. Like Solzhenitsyn, I shall return one bright dusk.
Half-Lives, the first Louisa Ray mystery. 40. The Black Sea roars in. Its coldness shocks Louisa's senses back to life. Her VW's rear struck the water at 45 degrees, so the seat saved her spine. But the car now swings upside down. She is trussed by her seatbelt inches from the windshield. Get out or die here. Louisa panics, breathes a lung full of water, and struggles into a pocket of air, coughing. Unhook this belt. She squirms and jackknifes up to the belt lock. Release button. It doesn't click. The car half somersaults deeper, and with a wrenching noise, a giant squid-shaped air bubble flies away. Louisa stabs the button, frantic, and the strap drifts free. More air. She finds an air pocket trapped beneath a windshield of dark water. The sea's mass jams the door shut. Roll down the window. It inches halfway and jams, right where it always jams. Louisa shimmies around, squeezes her head, shoulders, and torso through the gap. Sixsmith's report! She pulls herself back into the sinking vehicle. Can't see a damn thing. A plastic trash bag wedged under the seat. She doubles up in the confined space. It's here! She hauls, like a woman hauling a sack of rocks. She feeds herself feet first back out the window, but the report is too fat. The sinking car drags Louisa down. Her lungs ache now. The sodden papers have quadrupled their weight. The trash bag is through the window, but as she kicks and struggles, Louisa feels a lightening. Hundreds of pages spin free from the vanilla binder, wheeling wherever the sea will take them, wheeling around her. Playing cards in Alice. She kicks off her shoes. Her lungs shriek, curse, beg. Every pulse is a thump in Louisa's ears. Which way is up? The water is too murky to guess. Up is away from the car. Her lungs will collapse in another moment. Where's the car? Louisa realizes she has paid for the Sixsmith report with her life. 41. Isaac Sachs looks down on a brilliant Pennsylvania morning. Labyrinthine suburbs of ivory mansionettes and silk lawns inset with turquoise swimming pools. The executive jet window is cool against his face. 6 feet directly beneath his seat is a suitcase in the baggage hold containing enough C4 to turn an airplane into a meteor. So, thinks Sachs, you obeyed your conscience. Louisa Ray has the Sixsmith report. He recollects as many details of her face as he can. Do you feel doubt, relief, fear, righteousness? A premonition I'll never see her again. Alberto Grimaldi, the man he has double-crossed, is laughing at an aide's remark. The hostess passes with a tray of clinking drinks. Sachs retreats into his notebook, where he writes the following sentences. Exposition. The workings of the actual past, plus the virtual past, may be illustrated by an event well known to collective history, such as the sinking of the Titanic. The disaster as it actually occurred descends into obscurity as its eyewitnesses die off. Documents perish, plus the wreck of the ship dissolves in its Atlantic grave. Yet a virtual sinking of the Titanic, created from reworked memories, papers, hearsay, fiction, in short, belief, grows ever truer. The actual past is brittle, ever dimming, plus ever more problematic to access, plus reconstruct. In contrast, the virtual past is malleable, ever brightening, plus ever more difficult to circumvent, expose, as fraudulent. The present presses the virtual past into its own service, to lend credence to its mythologies, plus legitimacy to the imposition of will. Power seeks, plus is, the right to landscape the virtual past. He who pays the historian calls the tune. Symmetry demands an actual plus virtual future, too. We imagine how next week, next year, or 2225 will shape up. A virtual future constructed by wishes, prophecies, plus daydreams. This virtual future may influence the actual future, as in a self-fulfilling prophecy. But the actual future will eclipse our virtual one as surely as tomorrow eclipses today. Like utopia, the actual future plus the actual past exist only in the hazy distance, where they are no good to anyone. Question. Is there a meaningful distinction between one simulacrum of smoke, mirrors, plus shadows, the actual past, from another such simulacrum, the actual future? One model of time, an infinite Matryoshka doll of painted moments, each shell, the present, encased inside a nest of shells, previous presents, I call the actual past, but which we perceive as the virtual past. The doll of now likewise encases a nest of presents yet to be, which I call the actual future, but which we perceive as the virtual future. Proposition. I have fallen in love with Louisa Ray. The detonator is triggered. The C4 ignites. The jet is engulfed by a fireball. The jet's metals, plastics, circuitry, its passengers, their bones, clothes, notebooks, and brains, all lose definition in flames exceeding 1200 degrees C. The uncreated and the dead exist solely in our actual and virtual pasts. Now the bifurcation of these two pasts will begin. 42. Betty and Frank needed to shore up their finances, Lloyd Hooks tells his breakfast audience in the Swanakie Hotel. A circle of neophytes and acolytes pays keen attention to the presidential energy guru. So they decide Betty would go on the game to get a little cash in hand. Night comes around. Frank drives Betty over to Whore Lane to ply her new trade. Hey, Frank, says Betty from the sidewalk. How much should I charge? Frank does the math and tells her, $100 for the whole shebang. So Betty gets out and Frank parks down a quiet alley. Pretty soon this guy drives up in his beat-up old Chrysler and propositions Betty. How much for all night, sugar? Betty says, $100. The guy says, I only got $30. What'll 30 buy me? So Betty dashes around to Frank and asks him. Frank says, tell him $30 buys a hand job. So Betty goes back to the guy. Lloyd Hooks notices Bill Smoke in the background. Bill Smoke raises one, two, three fingers. The three fingers become a fist. The fist becomes a slashing gesture. Alberto Grimaldi, dead. Isaac Sachs, dead. Louisa Ray, dead. Swindler, sneak, snoop. Hook's eyes tell Smoke he has understood, and a figment from a Greek myth surfaces in his mind. The sacred grove of Diana was guarded by a warrior priest on whom luxury was lavished, but whose tenure was earned by slaying his predecessor. When he slept, it was at the peril of his life. Grimaldi, you dozed for too long. So anyway, Betty goes back to the guy and says his 30'll buy a hand job, take it or leave it. The guy says, okay, sugar, jump in, I'll take the hand job. Is there a quiet alley around here? Betty has him drive around the corner to Frank's alley, and the guy unbelts his pants to reveal the most, you know, gargantuan schlong. Wait up, gasps Betty. I'll be right back. She jumps out of the guy's car and knocks on Frank's window. Frank lowers the window. What now? Hooks pauses for the punchline. Betty says, Frank, hey, Frank, lend this guy $70. The men who would be board members cackle like hyenas. Whoever said money can't buy you happiness, Lloyd Hooks thinks, basking. Obviously didn't have enough of the stuff. 43. Through binoculars, Hester Van Zandt watches the divers on their launch. An unhappy-looking barefoot teenager in a poncho ambles along the beach and pats Hester's mongrel. They found the car yet, Hester? Channel's pretty deep at that point. That's why the fishing's so good there. Hard to be sure at this distance. Kinda ironic to drown in the sea you're polluting. The guards kinda got the hots for me. Told me it was a drunk driver, a woman, about 4 in the morning. Swanicky Bridge comes under the same special security remit as the island. Seaboard can say what they like. No one'll cross-check their story. The teenager yawns. Do you suppose she drowned in her car, the woman? Or do you think she got out and kinda drowned later? Couldn't say. If she was drunk enough to drive through a railing, she couldn't have made it to the shore. Who knows? Gross way to die. The teenager yawns and walks off. Hester trudges back to her trailer. Milton, the Native American, sits on its step, drinking from a milk carton. He wipes his mouth and tells her, Wonder Woman's awake. Hester steps around Milton and asks the woman on the sofa how she is feeling. Lucky to be alive, answers Louisa Ray. Full of muffins and dryer. Thanks for the loan of your clothes. Lucky we're the same size. Divers are looking for your car. The Sixsmith report, not my car. My body would be a bonus. Milton locks the door. So you crashed through a barrier, dropped into the sea, got out of a sinking car, and swam 300 yards to shore with no injuries worse than mild bruising? It hurts plenty when I think of my insurance claim. Hester sits down. What's your next move? Well, first I need to go back to my apartment and get a few things. Then I'll go stay with my mother on Ewingsville Hill. Then, back to square one. I can't get the police or my editor interested in what's happening on Swanicky without the report. Will you be safe at your mother's? As long as Seaboard thinks I'm dead, Joe Napier won't come looking. When they learn I'm not, she shrugs, having gained an armor of fatalism from the events of the last 6 hours. Altogether safe, possibly not. An acceptable degree of risk. I don't do this sort of thing often enough to be an expert. Milton digs his thumbs into his pockets. I'll drive you back to Buenos Aires. Give me a minute. I'll go call a friend and get him to bring his pickup over. Good guy, says Louisa after he's left. I'd trust Milton with my life, answers Hester. 44. Milton strides over to the fly-blown general store that services the campsite, trailer park, beachgoers, traffic to Swanakie, and the isolated houses hereabouts. An Eagles song comes on a radio behind the counter. Milton feeds a dime into the phone, checks the walls for ears, and dials in a number from memory. Water vapor rises from the Swanakie cooling towers like malign genies. Pylons march north to Buenos Aires and south to Los Angeles. Funny, thinks Milton. Power, time, gravity, love. The forces that really kick ass are all invisible. The phone is answered.
Yeah.
Yeah, Napier, it's me. Listen, about a woman called Louisa Ray.
Well, suppose she isn't.
Suppose she's still walking around eating popsicles and paying utility bills.
Would her whereabouts be worth anything to you?
Yeah?
How much?
No, you name a figure.
Okay, double that.
No?
Nice talking with you, Napier. I gotta go and...
Milton smirks. The usual account within one working day, if you please.
Right.
What?
No, no one else has seen her. Only Crazy Van Zant.
No.
She did mention it, but it's in the bottom of the deep blue sea.
Quite sure.
Fish food.
Course not. My exclusives are for your ears only.
Uh-huh.
I'm driving her back to her apartment, then she's going to her mother's.
Okay, I'll make it an hour.
The usual account. One working day.
45.
Louisa opens her front door to the sounds of a Sunday ball game and the smell of popcorn.
Since when did I say you could fry oil?
She calls through to Javier.
Why are the blinds all down?
Javier bounces down the hallway, grinning.
Hi, Louisa. Your Uncle Joe made the popcorn. We're watching Giants versus Dodgers.
Why are you dressed like an old woman?
Louisa feels her core sicken.
Come here.
Where is he?
Javier sniggers.
On your sofa. What's up?
Come here. Your mom wants you.
She's working overtime at the hotel.
Louisa, it wasn't me on the bridge. It wasn't me.
Joe Napier appears behind him, holding out his palms as if reassuring a scared animal.
Listen.
Louisa's voice judders.
Javi, out. Behind me.
Napier raises his voice.
Listen to me.
Yes, I am talking with my own killer.
Why in hell should I listen to a word you say?
Because I'm the only insider at Seaboard who doesn't want you dead.
Napier's calm has deserted him.
In the parking lot, I was trying to warn you.
Think about it. If I was the hitman, would we even be having this conversation?
Don't go, for Christ's sake.
It's not safe. Your apartment could be under surveillance still. That's why the blinds are down.
Javier looks aghast.
Louisa holds the boy but doesn't know the least dangerous way to turn.
Why are you here?
Napier is quiet again, but tired and troubled.
I knew your father when he was a cop.
VJ Day on Silva Plana Wharf.
Come in, Louisa.
Sit down.
46.
Joe Napier calculated that the neighbor's kid would tether Louisa long enough to make her listen. He's not proud that his plan paid off. Napier, more a watcher than a speaker, chisels out his sentences with care. In 1945, I'd been a cop for 6 years at Spinoza District Station. No commendations, no black marks, a regular cop, keeping his nose clean, dating a regular girl in a typing pool. On the 14th of August, the radio said the Japs had surrendered, and Buenos Aires danced one almighty hula. Drink flowed, cars revved up, firecrackers were set off. People took a holiday, even if their bosses didn't give them one. Come 9 o'clock or so,
My partner and I were called to a hit and run in Little Korea. Normally, we didn't bother with that end of town. But the victim was a white kid, so there'd be relatives and questions. We were en route when a code 8 comes through from your father, calling all available cars to Silvaplana Wharf. Now, the rule of thumb was, you didn't go snooping around that part of the docks, not if you wanted a career. The mob had their warehouses there under a city hall umbrella. What's more, Lester Ray, Napier decides not to modify his language, was known as a 10th Precinct pain-in-the-ass Sunday school cop. But two officers were down, and that ain't the same ballgame. It could be your buddy bleeding to death on the tarmac. So we flat-outed and reached the wharf just behind another Spinoza car, Brosman and Harkins. Saw nothing at first. No sign of Lester Ray, no sign of a squad car. The dockside lights were off. We drove between two walls of cargo containers around the corner into a yard where men were loading up an army truck. I was thinking we were in the wrong zone of the docks. Then the wall of bullets hit us. Brosman and Harkins took the first wave. Brakes, glass filling the air, our car skidded into theirs, me and my partner rolled out of our car and holed up behind a stack of steel tubes. Brosman's car horn sounds, doesn't stop, and they don't appear. More bullets acking around us. I'm shitting myself. I'd become a cop to avoid war zones. My partner starts firing back. I follow his lead, but our chances of hitting anything are zilch. To be honest with you, I was glad when the truck trundled by. Dumbass that I was, I broke cover too soon to see if I could get a license plate. The root of Napier's tongue is aching. Then all this happens. A yelling man charges me from across the yard. I fire at him. I miss. The luckiest miss of my life. And yours too, Louisa, because if I'd shot your father, you wouldn't be here. Lester Ray is pointing behind me as he sprints by, and he kicks an object rolling my way, lobbed from the back of the truck. Then a blinding light fries me. A noise axes my head, and a needle of pain shoots through my butt. I lay where I fell, half-conscious, until I was hoisted into an ambulance. Louisa still isn't saying anything. I was lucky. A fragment of grenade shrapnel tore through both buttock cheeks. The rest of me was fine. The doctor said it was the first time he'd seen one projectile make four holes. Your dad, of course, was not so fine. Lester was a piece of Swiss cheese. They'd operated but failed to save his eye the day before I left the hospital. We just shook hands and I left. I didn't know what to say. The most humiliating thing you can do to a man is to save his life. Lester knew it, too. But there's not a day, possibly not an hour, that's gone by without my thinking about him. Every time I sit down. Louisa says nothing for a while. Why didn't you tell me this on Swanakie Island? Napier scratches his ear. I was afraid you'd use the connection to squeeze me for juice on what really happened to Rufus Sixsmith. Napier doesn't say yes. Doesn't say no. I know how reporters work. You are picking holes in my integrity? She's speaking generally. She can't know about Margot Roker. If you keep on looking for Rufus Sixsmith's report, Napier wonders if he should say this in front of the boy, you'll be killed. Plain and simple. Not by me. But it'll happen. Please, leave town now. Jettison your old life and job, and go. Alberto Grimaldi sent you to tell me that, did he? No one knows I'm here, pray God, or I'm in as much trouble as you. One question first. You want to ask if... he wishes the kid was elsewhere. If Sixsmith's fate was my work, the answer is no. That sort of job, it wasn't my business. I'm not saying I'm innocent. I'm just saying I'm guilty only of looking the other way. Grimaldi's fixer killed Sixsmith and drove you off the bridge last night. A man by the name of Bill Smoke. One name of many, I suspect. I can't make you believe me, but I hope you will.
How did you know I'd survived?
Vain hope. Look, life is more precious than a damn scoop. I'm begging you one last time, and it will be the last, to drop this story. Now I've got to leave, and I wish to Christ you'd do the same.
He stands.
One last thing. Can you use a gun?
I have an allergy to guns.
How do you mean?
Guns make me nauseous.
Literally. Everyone should learn to use a gun.
Yeah, you can see crowds of 'em laid out in morgues. Bill Smoke isn't going to wait politely while I get a gun out of my handbag, is he? My only way out is to get evidence that'll blow this affair so totally, killing me would be a pointless act.
You're underestimating man's fondness for petty revenge.
What do you care? You've paid back your debt to Dad. You've salved your conscience.
Napier gives a morose sigh.
Enjoyed the ball game, Javi.
You're a liar, says the boy. I lied, yes, but that doesn't make me a liar. Lying's wrong, but when the world spins backwards, a small wrong may be a big right.
That doesn't make sense.
You're damn right it doesn't, but it's still true.
Joe Napier lets himself out.
Javier is angry with Luisa, too.
And you act like I'm gambling with my life just because I jump across a couple of balconies?
47. Luisa's and Javier's footsteps reverberate in the stairwell. Javier peers over the handrail. Lower floors recede like the whorls of a shell. A wind of vertigo blows, making him giddy. It works the same looking upward.
If you could see into the future, he asks, would you?
Luisa slings her bag. Depends on if you could change it or not.
Supposing you could.
So say you saw you were going to be kidnapped by communist spies on the second story. You'd take the elevator down to the ground floor.
But what if the spies called the elevator, agreeing to kidnap whoever was in it? What if trying to avoid the future is what triggers it all?
If you could see the future, like you can see the end of 16th Street from the top of Kilroy's department store, that means it's already there. If it's already there, you can't change it.
Yes, but what's at the end of 16th Street isn't made by what you do.
It's pretty much fixed by planners, architects, designers, unless you go and blow a building up or something. What happens in a minute's time is made by what you do.
So what's the answer? Can you change the future or not?
Maybe the answer is not a function of metaphysics, but one simply of power.
It's a great imponderable, Javi.
They have reached the ground floor. The $6 million man's bionic biceps jangle on Malcolm's TV.
See you, Luisa.
I'm not leaving town forever, Javi.
At the boy's initiative, they shake hands.
The gesture surprises Luisa. It feels formal, final, and intimate.
48.
A silver carriage clock in Judith Ray's Ewingsville home tinkles 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Bill Smoke is being talked at by a financier's wife.
This house never fails to bring out the demon of covetousness in me, the 50-something bejeweled woman confides. It's a copy of a Frank Lloyd Wright. The original's on the outskirts of Salem, I believe.
She is standing an inch too close.
You look like a witch from the outskirts of Salem, gone fucking crazy in Tiffany's, Bill Smoke thinks, remarking.
Now, is that so?
Hispanic maids supplied by the caterers carry trays of food among the all-white guests. Swan-shaped linen napkins bear place cards.
That white-leafed oak tree on the front lawn would have been here when the Spanish missions were built, the wife says. Wouldn't you agree?
Without doubt.
Oaks live for 600 years. 200 to grow, 200 to live, 200 to die.
Smoke sees Louisa enter the lavish room, accepting a kiss on both cheeks from her stepfather.
What do I want from you, Louisa Ray?
A female guest of Louisa's age hugs her.
Louisa, it's been 3 or 4 years.
Close up, the guest's charm is caddish and prying.
But is it true you're not married yet?
I certainly am not, is Louisa's crisp reply.
Are you?
Smoke senses she senses his gaze, refocuses his attention on the wife, and agrees that, yes, there are redwoods not 60 minutes from here that were mature when Nebuchadnezzar was on his throne. Judith Ray stands on a footstool brought specially for the purpose and taps a silver spoon on a bottle of pink champagne until everyone is listening.
Ladies, gentlemen, and young people, she declaims, I am told dinner is served. But before we all begin, I'd like to say a few words about the wonderful work done by the Buenas Yerbas Cancer Society and how they'll use the monies from our fundraiser you are so generously supporting today.
Bill Smoke amuses a pair of children by producing a shiny gold Krugerrand from thin air. What I want from you, Louisa, is a killing of perfect intimacy. For a moment, Bill Smoke wonders at the powers inside us that are not us. 49. The maids have cleared the dessert course. The air is pungent with coffee fumes, and an overfed Sunday drowsiness settles on the dining room. The eldest guests find nooks to snooze in. Louisa's stepfather rounds up a group of contemporaries to see his collection of 1950s cars. The wives and mothers conduct maneuvers of illusion. The schoolchildren go outside to bicker in the leafy sunshine and around the pool. The Henderson triplets dominate the discourse at the matchmaking table. Each is as blue-eyed and gilded as his brothers, and Louisa doesn't distinguish among them.
What would I do, says one triplet, if I was president? First, I'd aim to win the Cold War, not just aim not to lose it.
Another takes over.
I wouldn't kowtow to Arabs whose ancestors parked camels on lucky patches of sand. Or to red gooks. I'd establish, I'm not afraid to say it, our country's rightful corporate empire. Because if we don't do it, the Japs will steal the march. The corporation is the future. We need to let business run the country and establish a true meritocracy. Not choked by welfare, unions, affirmative action for amputee, transvestite, colored, homeless arachnophobes. A meritocracy of acumen. A culture that is not ashamed to acknowledge that wealth attracts power. And that the wealth makers, us, are rewarded. When a man aspires to power, I ask one simple question. Does he think like a businessman?
Louisa rolls her napkin into a compact ball.
I ask 3 simple questions. How did he get that power? How is he using it? And how can it be taken off the son of a bitch?
50. Judith Ray finds Louisa watching an afternoon news report in her husband's den.
Bull dyke, I heard Anton Henderson say, and if it wasn't about you, Cookie, I don't know. It's not funny. Your rebellion issues are getting worse. You complain about being lonely, so I introduce you to nice young men, and you bull dyke them in your spyglass voice.
When did I ever complain about being lonely?
Boys like the Hendersons don't grow on trees, you know.
Aphids grow on trees. There is a knock on the door, and Bill Smoke peers in.
Mrs. Ray, sorry to intrude, but I have to leave soon. Hand on heart, today was the most welcoming,
best organized fundraiser I've ever attended.
Judith Ray's hand flutters to her ear.
Most kind of you to say so.
Herman Howitt, junior partner at Musgrove Wyland, up from the Malibu office. I didn't get the chance to introduce myself before that superb dinner. I was the last-minute booking this morning. My father passed away over 10 years ago. God bless his soul. Cancer. I don't know how my mother and I would have gotten through it without the society's help. When Ollie mentioned your fundraiser, just out of the blue, I had to call to see if I could replace any last-minute cancellations.
We're very glad you did, and welcome to Buenos Aires.
A little short, assesses Judith Ray, but muscular, well-salaried, and probably on Louise's side of 35.
Junior partner sounds promising. I hope Mrs. Howitt can join you next time.
Bill Smoke, a.k.a. Herman Howitt, does a mousy smile.
I'm sorry to say, the only Mrs. Howitt is my ma, so far.
Now is that a fact? Responds Judith Ray.
He peers at Louisa, who is not paying attention.
I admired your daughter's principled stand downstairs. So many of our generation seem to lack a moral compass nowadays.
I so agree. The 60s threw out the baby with the bathwater. Louise's departed father and myself separated some years ago, but we always aimed to instill a sense of right and wrong in our daughter. Louisa, will you tear yourself away from the television set for just a moment, please, dear? Herman will be thinking, Louisa? Cookie, what is it?
The anchorman intones. Police confirm the 12 killed on a Learjet accident over the Allegheny Mountains this morning included Seaboard Power CEO Alberto Grimaldi, America's highest-paid executive. Preliminary reports from FAA investigators suggest an explosion triggered by a defect in the fuel system. Wreckage is strewn over several square miles.
Louisa, Cookie.
Judith Ray kneels by her daughter, who stares aghast at pictures of twisted airplane pieces on a mountainside.
How appalling!
Bill Smoke savors a complex dish, all of whose ingredients even he, the chef, can't list.
Did you know any of those poor souls, Miss Ray?
51. Monday morning. The Spyglass newsroom swarms with rumors. One has it the magazine is bust. Another, that Kenneth P. Ogilvy, its owner, will auction it off. The bank is giving a fresh transfusion. The bank is pulling the plug. Louisa hasn't informed anyone that she survived a murder attempt 24 hours ago. She doesn't want to involve her mother or Grelsch. And except for her bruising, it is all increasingly unreal. Louisa does feel grief over the death of Isaac Sachs, a man she hardly knew. She is also afraid, but focuses on work. Her father told her how war photographers refer to an immunity from fear bestowed by the camera lens. This morning, it makes perfect sense. If Bill Smoke knew about Isaac Sachs' defection, his death makes sense. But who wanted Alberto Grimaldi taken down at the same time? The staff writers gravitate into Dom Grelsch's office as usual for the 10 o'clock meeting. 10:15 comes around.
Grelsch wasn't this late even when his first wife gave birth, says Nancy O'Hagan, polishing her nails.
Ogilvy's got him screwed into an instrument of torture. Roland Jakes gouges wax from his ear with a pencil.
I met the drummer who'd done the actual drumming on the Monkees hits. He was banging on about tantric sex, I thank you. His favorite position is, called the plumber. You stay in all day, but nobody comes.
Silence.
Geez, just trying to lighten the vibes.
Grelsch arrives and wastes no time.
Spyglass is being sold. We'll learn later today who will survive this sacrificial call.
Jerry Nussbaum loops his thumbs through his belt.
Sudden.
Damn sudden. Negotiations began late last week.
Grelsch simmers.
By this morning it was a done deal.
Must have been, one hell of an offer,
angles Jakes.
Ask KPO that.
Who's the buyer? Asks Louisa.
Press announcement later today.
Come on, Dom,
wheedles O'Hagan.
I said there'll be a press announcement later today.
Jakes rolls a cigarette.
Seems like our mystery buyer, really wants Spyglass. And, if it ain't broken, don't fix it.
Nussbaum snorts.
Who says our mystery buyer doesn't think we're broken? When Allied News bought Nouveau last year, they even fired the window cleaners.
So, O'Hagan clicks her compact shut.
My cruise up the Nile is off again. Back to my sister-in-law's in Chicago for Christmas. Her brats and the frozen beef capital of the world. What a difference a day makes.
52. For months, Joe Napier realizes, looking at the coordinated artwork in Vice CEO William Wiley's anteroom, he has been sidelined. Loyalties snaked out of sight, and power was tapped from the known ducts. That was fine by me, Napier thinks. Only a year and a half to go. He hears footsteps and feels a draft. But downing an airplane with 12 men on board isn't security. It's multiple homicide. Who gave the order? Was Bill Smoke working for Wiley? Could it just be an aviation accident? They happen. All I understand is that not understanding is dangerous. Napier berates himself for warning off Louisa Ray yesterday, a stupid risk that achieved a big nothing. William Wiley's secretary appears at the door.
Mr. Wiley will see you now, Mr. Napier.
Napier is surprised to see Fei Li in the office. The setting demands an exchange of smiles. William Wiley's,
Joe, how are you?
Is as vigorous as his handshake.
A sad morning, Mr. Wiley,
replies Napier, taking the seat but refusing the cigarette.
I still can't take it in about Mr. Grimaldi.
I never liked you. I never saw what you were for.
None sadder. Alberto can be succeeded, but never replaced.
Napier permits himself one question under the guise of small talk. How long will the board leave it before discussing a new appointment?
We're meeting this afternoon. Alberto wouldn't want us to drift without a helmsman for longer than necessary.
You know, his respect for you, personally, was, well,
devout,
suggests Fei Li. You have come up in the world, Mr. Li.
Precisely, exactly, devout.
Mr. Grimaldi was a great guy.
He sure was, Joe. He sure was.
Wiley turns to Fei Li.
Fei, let's tell Joe about the package we're offering.
In recognition of your exemplary record, Mr. Wiley is proposing to set you free early. You'll receive full pay for the 18 months still on your contract, your bonus, then your index-linked pension will kick in.
Walk the plank.
Napier makes a wow expression.
Bill Smoke is behind this.
Wow fits both the retirement offer and Napier's sense of the seismic shift in his role from insider to liability.
This is unexpected.
Must be, Joe, says Wiley, but adds nothing.
The telephone rings.
No, snaps Wiley into the mouthpiece.
Mr. Reagan can wait his turn. I'm busy. Napier has decided by the time Wiley hangs up. A golden chance to exit a bloodstained stage. He plays an old retainer, speechless with gratitude.
Fay, Mr. Wiley, I don't know how to thank you.
William Wiley peers like a jokey coyote.
By accepting?
Of course I accept.
Wiley and Faley are all congratulations.
You understand, of course, Wiley continues. With a post as delicate as security, we need for the change to come into force when you leave this room.
Jesus, you people don't waste a second, do you?
Faley adds, I'll have your effects shipped on, plus paperwork. I know you won't be offended by an escort to the mainland. Mr. Wiley has to be seen to respect protocol.
No offense, Faye.
Napier smiles, cursing her.
I wrote our protocol.
Napier, keep your 38 strapped to your calf until you're off Swanakie, and for a long time after. 53. The music in the Lost Chord music store subsumes all thoughts of Spyglass, Sixsmith, Sax, and Grimaldi. The sound is pristine, river-like, spectral, hypnotic, intimately familiar. Louisa stands entranced, as if living in a stream of time. I know this music, she tells the store clerk, who eventually asks if she's okay. What the hell is it?
I'm sorry, it's a customer order, not for sale. I shouldn't really be playing it.
Oh.
First things first.
I phoned last week. My name's Ray, Louisa Ray. You said you could find an obscure recording for me by Robert Frobisher, Cloud Atlas Sextet. But forget that for a moment. I have to own this music, too. I have to. You know what it's like. What is it?
The clerk presents his wrists for imaginary handcuffs. Cloud Atlas Sextet by Robert Frobisher. I listen to it to make sure it's not scratched.
Oh, I lie. I listen to it because I'm a slave to curiosity.
Not exactly Delius, is it?
Why companies won't finance recordings of gems like this? It's criminal.
Your record is in the mintest condition, I'm happy to report.
Where have I heard it before?
The young man shrugs. Can't be more than a handful in North America.
But I know it. I'm telling you, I know it.
54. Nancy O'Hagan is speaking excitedly on her phone when Louisa returns to the office.
Cheryl. Cheryl? It's Nancy. Listen, we may yet spend Christmas in the shadow of the Sphinx. The new owner is Transvision, Inc.
She raises her voice.
Transvision, Inc. Me neither, but...
O'Hagan lowers her voice.
I've just seen KPO. Yeah, the old boss. He's on the new board. But listen up. What I'm calling to say is, my job's safe.
She gives Louisa a frenetic nod.
Uh-huh. Almost no jobs are being axed. So phone Janine and tell her she's spending Christmas alone with her abominable little snowmen.
Louisa, Grelsch calls from his doorway. Mr. Ogilvie'll see you now.
K.P. Ogilvie occupies Dom Grelsch's temperamental chair, exiling the editor to a plastic stacking seat. In the flesh, Spyglass's proprietor reminds Louisa of a steel engraving, of a Wild West judge.
There's no nice way to say this, he begins, so I'll just say it the blunt way. You're fired. Orders of the new owner.
Louisa watches the news bounce off her. No, it can't compare to being driven off a bridge into the sea in semi-darkness.
Grelsch can't meet her eye.
I've got a contract.
Who hasn't? You're fired.
Am I the only staff writer to incur your new master's displeasure?
So it would seem.
K.P. Ogilvie's jaw flinches once.
I think it's fair to ask, why me?
Owners hire, fire, and say what's fair. When a buyer offers a rescue package of the bounty that Transvision offered, one doesn't nitpick.
A picked nit.
Can I have that on my gold watch?
Dom Grelsch squirms. Mr. Ogilvy, I think Louisa's entitled to some kind of an explanation.
Then she can go ask Transvision. Perhaps her face doesn't fit their vision of spyglass. Too radical. Too feminist. Too dry. Too pushy.
He's trying to make a smokescreen.
I'd like to ask Transvision a number of things. Where's their head office?
Out east somewhere. But I doubt anyone will see you.
Out east somewhere. Who are your new fellow board members?
You're being fired, not taking down an affidavit.
Just one more question, Mr. Ogilvy. For 3 magical years of unstinting service, just answer this. What's the overlap between Transvision and Seaboard power?
Dom Grelsch's own curiosity is sharp.
Ogilvy hesitates a fraction, then blusters.
I've got a lot of work to get through. You'll be paid until the end of the month. No need to come in. Thank you, and goodbye.
Where there's bluster, thinks Louisa, there's duplicity. 55. You are now leaving Swanakie County, home of the surf, home of the atom. Don't stay away too long.
Life's okay.
Joe Napier shifts his Jeep into cruise control.
Life's good.
Seaboard power, his working life, Margot Roker and Louisa Ray recede into his past at 80 miles per hour.
Life's great.
2 hours to his log cabin in the Santo Cristo Mountains. He could catch catfish for supper if he's not too tired by the drive. He checks his mirror. A silver Chrysler has been sitting 100 yards behind him for a mile or two, but now it overtakes and vanishes into the distance.
Relax, Napier tells himself. You've gotten away.
Something in his Jeep is rattling. The afternoon reaches its 3 o'clock golden age. The freeway runs alongside the river for mile after mile, slowly climbing.
Upcountry's gotten uglier in the last 30 years. But show me a place that hasn't.
Either side, housing developments colonize the bulldozer-leveled shelves.
Getting out took me all my life.
Buenos Yerbas dwindles to a bristling smudge in Napier's rearview mirror.
You can't stop Lester's daughter playing Wonder Woman. You gave it your best shot. Let her go. She ain't a kid.
He sifts the radio waves. But it's all men singing like women and women singing like men. Until he finds a hokey country station playing Everybody's Talkin'. Millie was the musical half of his marriage. Napier revisits the first evening he saw her. She was playing fiddle for Wild Oakum Hokum and his cowgirls in the sand. The glances musicians exchange, when music is effortless. That was what he wanted from Millie, that intimacy.
Louisa Ray is too a kid.
Napier turns off at exit 18 and takes the old gold miner's road up toward Copper Line.
That rattling isn't getting any better.
Fall is licking the mountain woods up here. The road follows a gorge under ancient pines to where the sun goes down. He's here, all of a sudden, unable to recall a single thought from the last 3/4 of an hour. Napier pulls over at the grocery store, kills the engine, and swings out of his Jeep.
Hear that rushing? The lost river.
It reminds him Copperline isn't Buenos Yerbas, and he unlocks his Jeep again. The store owner greets his customer by name, delivers 6 months' gossip in as many minutes, and asks if Napier's on vacation for the whole week.
I'm on permanent vacation now. I was offered early...
He's never used the word on himself before.
Retirement. Took it like a shot.
The store owner's gaze is all-seeing.
Celebration at Duane's tonight? Or commiseration at Duane's tomorrow?
Make it Friday.
Celebration, mostly.
I want to spend my first week of freedom resting in my cabin.
Not poleaxed under Duane's tables.
Napier pays for his groceries and leaves, suddenly hungry to be alone. The jeep's tires crunch the stony